Why do I conduct my show on this manner? Mondo!
Sweet mother of God, what is the holdup?
Eleanor!
Once again, something wonderful in my life has been turned into a giant crap fest.
Mondo!
Got a little bit more cock for you here.
Eleanor!
Bowtie boy got the big snaggeroonie.
Mondo!
Oh, six of my nipples are tingling.
Eleanor!
See why America loves him so much?
Mondo!
I'd like to smash you in the face with my shillelagh.
Eleanor!
I have no idea what's going on.
Mondo!
He was lying.
He said he never tells a lie.
He was lying when he said that.
Eleanor!
I want a cup.
Well, could you spell that?
C-U-P. I want to see you. Oh, my God.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Stomach batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
For God's sake, strap yourself down.
That's right. It's the show your bosses don't want you to listen to. The show that's going to tell you the truth about what's going on in the workplace. So wake the hell up. It's the Cup of Joe radio show. I am your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man, the voice of the radical middle, and the voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. Our engineer, Sock Puppet Sam, is here! And we've got a lot of stuff to talk about, but first, Sam, give us the URL for the site.
That's cupojoe.blogspot.com.
And the email address.
joevec@bellsouth.net.
All right, I want to welcome all of my fans listening in at the White Rose Society. That's whiterosesociety.org. My good friend Ben Birch hosting my archives there. And, of course, all my fans at rantsradio.com listening in on Thursdays and Sundays. And welcome to show number 75. It is Sunday, November 28th, 2004. It's actually late Saturday, early Sunday, 1:03 a.m. Why am I doing the show now? Why the hell not? I'm just doing it earlier on, hopefully, at least to get this first segment done and out of the way. Before it gets ready to air, you know, I've really kind of procrastinated on it. I could have done the show at any time on Saturday, but I don't know. It's just one of those days where I didn't feel like doing anything. The wife is visiting the kids. I will be picking her up, later on today, whenever I get up today. And, just a day where I've spent chilling out on the web, watching a little TV, not doing a whole hell of a lot. I'm sure you've had days like that. And, of course, it being a holiday weekend, it's the next to last day off. And I just kind of wanted to take things easy. I was actually busy on Thursday. I hope everybody had a good Thanksgiving, by the way. We had a very quiet one here. I cooked the turkey. I do like to cook. I'm one of those guys that enjoys it. I didn't do anything too fancy. I mean, we had stovetop stuffing instead of, you know, regular real stuffing that you would make yourself. But, you know, I cooked the turkey and I cooked the potatoes and we had a very nice meal and I'm very happy and we've got plenty of leftovers. I got a 15-pound bird to feed the two of us, knowing that we'd have a lot of leftovers because I rather like leftovers and I like heating them up and eating them, at a later date, as I'm sure some of you do and some of you don't. Some of you got, you know, Thanksgiving you have turkey and Christmas you're supposed to have turkey, so I guess you wind up with a whole hell of a lot of it. I don't think we'll make turkey on Christmas, but we'll see. Maybe we'll make some Italian dish instead. That's what my family would do. We would have the traditional turkey stuff on either Thanksgiving or Christmas, and then the other holiday we would have Italian food just to break up the monotony. I was watching C-SPAN Friday night or Saturday morning. No, it was Friday evening, I believe, and I had Bill Cosby on, and it was some awards presentation show, and he was there with Reverend Jesse Jackson, and he was, you know, talking about the subject he has been talking about for a while, about, you know, how badly a job that we're doing raising kids these days. And for the most part, I agree with what he has to say. The difference is that we do live in a different world now than he did then. Mr. Cosby did not grow up rich. He's a very wealthy and successful person, very professional person, highly intelligent, hardworking, well-educated, extraordinarily talented beyond even the realm of people who are, you know, you normally see on TV, one of the most talented entertainers that we've had in our history. But he didn't start off, you know, from a rich family with a lot of privilege. He grew up in a relatively poor family. But the difference is when he was growing up, people like myself, who were just regular working people, could actually earn enough of a living to support a family properly. Even if you lived in a big city like Philadelphia, where he is from. And it just doesn't happen that way. And I understand his criticisms of parents and stuff like that. And he's not talking to all parents. But he does say, you know, he talks about the parents who play the rap music with the obscenities in front of their kids and things like that. And I agree with him in that respect. Because even though people work hard and they don't make the kind of money that, relatively speaking, his parents made back then or that my parents made back then, there's a difference between, as he said, being broke and being poor. And while I have always been broke, I'm not necessarily poor in that sense. I mean, I've called myself a poor person on the show, and I'm not good at money. I never have been good with money. I've never been good at making it. I've been too good at spending it. I suppose you can say that's the case for most of us out there. You know, and I'm not the most responsible person in the world when it comes to that. And I don't really know why some people are better with it than other people. I guess it's just a skill or a talent that some people have that others don't. But, you know, it's very difficult to try to work yourself out of that if you don't have, you know, a particular skill. Or if you don't really know where you're going. But the point I'm trying to make is that back then, there was a difference. I mean, you made a lot less money, but you paid a lot less for rent, and you were able to instill within your children a better sense of self-respect and dignity. And the reason you were able to do that is because the society itself back then was very different from what it is now. And maybe Mr. Cosby doesn't understand that. Maybe he only sees the part of it that he can possibly see being as he is in the upper echelons. Of course, Mr. Cosby is no saint himself. He has had an affair. So had Reverend Jesse Jackson, who was with him. A lot of powerful people and a lot of people you would think shouldn't be having these types of affairs do have them. And it does lessen them in my eyes, but it doesn't lessen what they have to say when they make a point. And I criticized Mr. Cosby when he made his initial speech on basically the same type of grounds that I'm talking about now, where, you know, it's a different world. You know, parents have it a lot tougher now than they did back then. Of course, he wasn't talking about all parents. And again, to the extent that we use demeaning language with each other, and especially among the black community, using the N-word to each other all the time, and I've used that word too. I don't use it among my black friends, obviously. But, you know, how black people take pride in using that name for each other. Or, you know, with the hoes and the bitches and the N-word back and forth all each other. And in some cases in black culture, the emphasis on not getting education, that the idea that getting educated is a bad thing. That's certainly an important issue that needs to be dealt with within the black community, but also from all of us. Lack of education is bad. At any rate, I wanted to say this because I do this radio show. And because I do this radio show, obviously I want to have my feelings heard. But who the hell am I to talk to people about this? I mean, you can see it coming from Mr. Cosby, who's an obvious success in life, who's worked hard and been a little lucky, because sometimes it takes more than work. But you know, he's done everything the right way. And has earned the respect of so many different people. And here I am, I'm just a guy with a mic. Maybe trying to, you know, use this as a way of busting out of my own poverty. But, you know, it's I'm not like the other radio talk show hosts, because I don't sit here and claim to be your perfect host, the perfect, you know, the talent from loan from God. I know what I am. I'm just a guy who feels strongly about certain things and is intelligent enough to look at things from a point of view that other people who are in my situation wouldn't see. Not because they're incapable of it, but because they're too busy being caught up with their own lives and their own problems. And that's a disadvantage for me as far as the work is concerned, because it makes it more difficult for me to get and hold on to a job. But it does allow me a certain point of view, a certain perspective on life from this level. But I wanted to make something very clear. Do not use me as an example of how you should live your life. I am a poor example. In fact, one of the reasons I even have this show is for you to have, you out there listening, to have someone like myself who is an example of someone you should not be. Learn from my experience. You know? What the other side does, what a lot of the other talk shows, and I'm not talking about my friends on the left, you know who I'm talking about. What they do is they sit there and say, I am a more moral person than you are. You can believe what I say to you because I am someone whose lives you can emulate. And because of that, you can feel free to believe that everything I tell you is the truth. Talent on loan from God. And when those people say that, that gives them the license to lie to you, to take advantage of your trust, to take advantage of your loyalty, and in the end, ultimately, make you spill your blood and risk your life for what will ultimately be their benefit. What I do on this show is try to talk to you about what will be for your benefit. And when I talk about liberalism, I'm not talking about it from the social engineer guys wearing sweaters with the elbow pads, smoking the pipe with the bearded, you know, the old hippies or the people who live in the benefit of wealth that I've never had, that most of you have never had. And even though they call themselves liberal, I am looking from the point of view of the working person who is just trying to struggle to make it in a world that I don't quite fit into. You can say it's laziness, and that's partly true, but there's also just a sense of not liking what goes on so much that you don't feel like you want to be a part of it. Maybe there's a bit of attention disorder. What do they call that? Attention deficit disorder. Where I get bored with something very easily. But when you talk about liberalism and you talk about its origins and its foundations here in the United States and its culmination in the New Deal, the people who helped put together the New Deal, what they really wanted, first and foremost, was dignity. Dignity in the sense of being able to go out and work and earn enough money to support yourself. That's dignity. And the beginning of that kind of dignity is self-respect. And we get self-respect, that is, we on the left, we get self-respect from our work, from doing what we need to do to support ourselves, our families, and our children. We do that by really being responsible to yourself, responsible to your family, responsible to your country, responsible to something that is greater than any individual can ever be. And there's a lot of talk about the welfare state. The welfare state was not designed to help people be irresponsible, and I'm not denying that there are people who take advantage of the system, but the welfare state was designed so that when the societal problems, or that's a bad term, but for when people fall through the cracks, that there's something there to help them, pick them back up off their feet, pat them on the back, and have them get a start again. There are people who have taken advantage of that in the way that it should have been taking advantage. I'll use my sister as an example. You know, she took, you know, welfare for a while, and she had to because she was a single mom who was one of the working poor. She never stopped working, but she was also going to school, and she was raising a child. And because she got the help that she needed when she needed it, she was able to put her life together, and now she has a very good job. She's an editor for Newsday newspaper in New York. She works in the entertainment section, and she makes decent money. And she has a wonderful family and a wonderful place to live. And, you know, that's the way it's supposed to be. And again, have people taken advantage of the system? Sure, there have. But no different from big corporations taking advantage of the system in huge ways. In huge ways, much more than all of the people who took advantage of welfare combined. You know? Now, the other side, the people on the right, the Rushes and the Hannitys, they talk about responsibility. They talk a lot about self-respect. But, you know, they get their self-respect. They bring themselves up by putting other people down. To them, that is the measure of their self-worth. How much they can put people down and how superior they can portray themselves to others. And because there's people who are willing to pay these people good money to send out their message, you very rarely see any of them in a position like myself, just on the levels of poverty and right on the edge, worrying about whether you're going to have some place to live. You never have a problem with that. So long as they're good enough to send the message and willing enough to say what these people want them to say, they'll never have to worry about these mundane things. And when I see the people on our side try to do what they do, I cringe because, firstly, we're not as good at it as they are. I'm not as good at it. I can't really be that kind of, you know, put people down, you know, to make myself feel good. I'm not going to be that way. You know, or if like the Sean Kennedy, I am the fucking man type of deal. I'm really not like that. I'm a guy with a microphone, with a need to talk and a need to express myself. But when we try to be like they are, and we try to just put them down, and when I read every stupid insult that I read on the different blogs and different websites and different message forums, I just cringe. It gives them the moral high ground to say that we're just the same as they are. I'm certainly not. And the attitude of just putting people down or yelling at each other, trying to outshout each other, this sort of thing permeates our society. The things that I used to like to watch, sports shows and things like that, and political talk shows. Well, I haven't really been able to watch those very much recently. But the type of shows that I would normally like to watch, especially in sports, all I see now is people yelling and screaming at each other. Have you seen, like, the best damn sports show ever? And that's really all it is, people trying to, you know, put each other down and stuff like that. And it's like, look, you know, it's really not necessary to do that. But a lot of people like to see that. And when I do see that, you know, it really just kind of sickens me. You know, and not because people are screaming at each other. People have been screaming at each other since before language was invented. But because so many people watch this and mistake it for debate. You know, when Jon Stewart went on Crossfire and told both sides that they were hurting America, he was saying something that we all know, but we hardly ever talk about out loud. This is bad. Even from the point of view of left versus right, it's just bad. It's pointless. It's mean. It's bad for all of us, regardless of what side of the political spectrum you're on. And this win-at-all-costs attitude is just it permeates our society. It comes into play wherever we go. There is no longer a sense of dignity. There's no sense of self-respect. There's only a childish one-upmanship whose whole foundation is fear and ignorance. A fear that you're not as good as somebody, and an ignorance of what's going on around you, what's going on in the rest of the world, what's even going on in your life. And it's, I don't really have words for it anymore. You know, it's just the way things are. And I don't know what to do to change it. This is the best I have to offer. And I know that there are some of you out there who are listening. And there are some of you out there from other countries who are listening to my show. I got an email from Germany and England today from different people who wrote in saying how much they like the show. And I'm grateful for that. You know, and you have to look towards what all the things that we have in common with each other. And those are more important than the things that set us apart. Bill Clinton's been saying that. And, you know, but nobody really wants to listen. So, I don't know. I don't have any. I don't have all the answers, and I'm not pretending to have all the answers. And I want to try to separate myself from a lot of the other talk shows, even a lot of the other left-wingers who claim that, you know, they just know. I wonder, by the way, how long Al Franken is going to stay on the radio show. You have to think that he would have been deflated somewhat by Mr. Bush's victory, quote-unquote, in the election. Because we got the sense, a lot of us on the left got the sense that things were going to change. But I knew that it wasn't going to happen. Not because I think that Mr. Bush is deserving or that I think Mr. Kerry ran a bad campaign. But because I think I understand where the country is going and where the country has to go. How bad it has to get before things reverse itself. And whether or not we can still solve these things internally or they get solved for us by outside forces who are not going to put up with it. That, to me, is going to be the question in the future because we can't continue like this. Michael Medved was on earlier on C-SPAN. I was watching a little bit about it. I'm a little wary of listening to him. But again, he's another, like Mr. Cosby, he's a very well-educated, professional person. And he talked about how much television we watch. And I've, you know, and how much we watch and compare it to how much we work, which is remarkable when you consider that we actually spend more time in our lives now watching television than we do at our jobs. That says something right there. And that most people get their news from television, which always is pandering to the lowest common denominator. At least it has been for the last 20 or 25 years or so. And the effect that it has on us. And it's not good. I've heard a couple of people talking about some boycotts of stuff. Well, maybe we ought to have a week or a month where we just turn the fucking TV off. Turn it all off. And just go out and socialize with people like we used to do. Do something. I don't know. I don't have the answers. But until I do have the answers, let's have a little bit of music. We'll listen to our friends from BuzzFlash.com. And we'll be back later. Sam, play us out.
We'll be right back with more of the Tucker Joe Radio Show.
Welcome back to the BuzzFlash.com GOP Hypocrite of the Week. Well, Linda Schrenko looked like $1 million when she entered the federal courthouse in Atlanta this week. Actually, wearing her fur-trimmed jacket and sporting a facelift, you might say Schrenko looked like $614,000. That's the amount of money she's charged with embezzling from federal and education funds while she served as the superintendent of Georgia schools. The once-rising Republican star smiled at the cameras as she faced a 16-count federal indictment for stealing our money and using it for, among other things, the cosmetic surgery behind her 54-year-old youthful Republican grin. The former teacher jumped on the GOP bandwagon in 1994, becoming the first woman elected to statewide office in the Peach State. She was reelected in 1998 as voters were unaware that she allegedly had her hand in the taxpayers' cookie jar. And the money the government charges her with stealing came from funds for the education of children. We guess Mrs. Schrenko will just defend herself by claiming that she was following George W. Bush's example of leaving every child behind. The head of the Georgia Republican Party says Schrenko, quote, had a lot of support from the Christian conservatives in the Republican Party, both in her gubernatorial run and in her tenure as school superintendent, unquote. You could feel the love between the radical right creationists and Schrenko. After all, she wanted Bible classes in public schools, and she once warned Georgian parents not to join the PTA because it was supposedly too liberal, and aghast, said that it supported gay rights. You know, George W. Bush must feel nothing but compassionate conservatism toward the martyred Ms. Schrenko, now bankrupt and divorced. According to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, U.S. Magistrate Judge Joel Feldman asked Schrenko to describe her level of education. She replied that she had completed a six-year postgraduate program and had obtained a, quote, leadership certificate, unquote, which allows her to be a school administrator. Upon hearing that, the judge said there should be no question about Schrenko's ability to read, write, and understand the English language, a common question defendants are asked to make sure they understand the charges against them. Hope not, replied Schrenko, who championed phonics-based reading programs as state school superintendent. If Bush's new appointment to head the Department of Education doesn't work out, he's found the right replacement in Ms. Schrenko. Considering how little Bush reads, he'll need all the hooked-on phonics tapes he can get his hands on. The only question is, can a Republican former school teacher head a federal agency from behind bars? If so, she's a ringer for a Bush appointee, because there's nothing that Bush likes more than thieves, liars, and hypocritical Christians. Congratulations, Linda Schrenko. You're this week's GOP Hypocrite of the Week. Until next week, just remember our motto at BuzzFlash.com. So many Republican hypocrites, so little time. Catch up with you soon.
Chapter 1. Democracy Before America. In this chapter, you will witness thousands of years of history casually dismissed in a few minutes. Learn the difference between a totalitarian regime and a post-communist kleptocracy. Realize that no matter how horrible your life is, it's not as bad as a feudal serf's.
It is often said that America invented democracy. This view is, of course, an understatement. America invented not only democracy, but freedom, justice, liberty, and time-sharing. But representative democracy is unquestionably our proudest achievement, a creation most uniquely our own. Even if the rest of the Western world would have come up with the idea themselves by the 1820s. So why, then, has participation in this most wondrous system withered? As heirs to a legacy more than two centuries old, it is understandable why present-day Americans would take their own democracy for granted. A president freely chosen from a wide-open field of two men every 4 years, a Congress with a 99% incumbency rate, a Supreme Court comprised of nine politically appointed judges whose only oversight is the icy scythe of death. All these reveal a system fully capable of maintaining itself. But our perfect democracy, which neither needs nor particularly wants voters, is a rarity. It is important to remember there still exist many other forms of government in the world today, and that dozens of foreign countries still long for a democracy such as ours to be imposed on them. To regain our sense of perspective and wonder, we must take a broader historical view, looking beyond America's relatively recent success story to examine our predecessors and their adorable failures. In this chapter, we will briefly explore the evolution of an idea, following the HMS Democracy on a dangerous voyage through the mists of time, past the Straits of Monarchy, surviving Hurricane Theocracy, then navigating around the Cape of Good Feudal System to arrive battered, but safe, at her destined port of call, America Town. Early man, more animal than political. The human race is by nature brutal, amoral, unreasonable, and self-centered. But for the first few hundred thousand years of our existence as a species, we were way too obvious about it. Primitive culture centered on survival of the individual, and occasionally survival of someone the individual might want to reproduce with. Civic institutions were non-existent, as was debate, which would appear later after the invention of the frontal lobe. For prehistoric man, the rule of law, such as it was, could best be summed up by the seminal case Marbury's Head versus Madison's Rock. Early man lived this tenuous Darwinian nightmare for an age or two, until a peculiar thing happened. The unfittest decided they wouldn't mind surviving either. The feeble and weak realized that without a good plan, they weren't going to make it out of the Stone Age to see the wonder that was clay. Alone, they were mammoth meat. Together, they would become a force, with a chance to see the day when their children's children would be only 75% covered in hair. From these noble impulses, the groundwork for the first civilizations was laid. Athens, our big fat Greek forerunners. Ancient Greece is widely credited with creating the world's first democracy. It would be a worthy endeavor to travel back in time to the Phaedo-strewn shores of 5th century BC Athens and ask Plato to define democracy, and not only to make money gambling on Olympic results that we, being from the future, would already know. Plato would tell us, in that affectionate but non-sexual way of his, that democracy is a Greek word, combining the roots for people, demos, and rule, kratia. In Greek democracy, political power was concentrated not in the hands of one person, or even a small group of people, but rather evenly and fairly distributed among all the people, meaning every John Q. Publicopolis could play a role in Athenian government. The main legislative body, the assembly, was comprised of no less than the first 6,000 citizens to arrive at its meetings. And bear in mind, no saving seats. Jury duty was considered an honor to be vied for. Membership in most other civic institutions, including the Supreme Court, was chosen by lot. Imagine a system in which anyone could wind up serving on the Supreme Court. Anyone. Think about your own family, friends, the guys you knew in college who would eat dog feces for $10. Now picture him as the randomly chosen Chief Justice, and you'll appreciate just how fucked up this system was. Compared with American democracy, the Athenian version seems simplistic, naive, and gay. Yet transcripts of early Athenian policy debates reveal a populace moved more by eloquence and rationality than demagogues and fear-mongering. Thankfully, this type of humane governance wasn't allowed to take root. Athens' great experiment ended after less than two centuries, when, in 338 BC, Philip of Macedon's forces invaded the city, inflicting on its inhabitants the eternal fate of the noble and enlightened, to be brutally crushed by the armed and dumb.
And welcome back to the Cup of Joe radio show. I'm your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, voice of the working man, voice of the radical middle, voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. Once again, the URL for the site is cupojoe.blogspot.com, and the email address is joevec, that's V as in victory, at bellsouth.com. Net. I hope everyone's having a good day today. It is 8:19 p.m. on Thursday, November 28th, 2004. Excuse me, Sunday, November 28th. Sunday. Get the date right, Joe. Sunday, November 28th, 2004. Oh, before I forget, I want to welcome back the White Rose Society. They had been having a combination of technical and personal difficulties for Ben Birch, who runs the White Rose Society. And they hadn't updated my archives there for quite some time, but Ben has returned, and the technical problems have been solved. And I can tell you for sure now that you can find all the shows up to number 74 on the White Rose Society. So I highly recommend you go there if you want to get back shows. That is, in fact, the only place you can get back episodes of the Cup of Joe radio show. That's www.whiterosesociety.org. And I interviewed Ben Birch some time ago concerning that. And they're about to be making some changes to the board. I won't go into too much detail about that. But they're going to be making some changes to that and hopefully getting some sponsorship of some sort. And we'll see where it goes from there. It's doing very well. I'm still trying to get on Air America Radio. I'm still trying to get on Sirius Radio. We'll see how that works there. You know, we'll figure something out. Sirius is what I'd prefer because it would allow me to use the profanity that I use from time to time. My wife doesn't like it, but, you know, that's part of my appeal. That's part of my style. I try to cut it out, but, you know, whatever. Whatever. A lot of things going on in the news today. There was an election in Ukraine that apparently has been invalidated. And because the exit poll said one thing and the vote said another thing, and no one knows what's going to happen there now because the government said, well, the election wasn't valid, but they didn't say what they're going to do about it. So that's going to be an interesting fight. And, you know, the Russians, now the Ukraine, for those of you who don't know anything about that part of the world or know very little, and I know most of my audience has to be pretty knowledgeable about that because they're knowledgeable enough to find the site, which means that they've been looking around the web for a while. But for those of you who are listening in, you can I'll give you a little bit of background on what the Ukraine is. Now, Ukraine, of course, was part of the USSR, the United Socialist, whatever, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, I believe is what USSR stood for. But, you know, when Russia broke up, they've been trying very hard to get their own independence. They're like a state. You know, if you consider, you know, Georgia is a state, and Alaska and Alabama, all those states, Ukraine is kind of like a state. Russia prime is Russia, but there are a lot of differences. Latvia, Estonia, you know, and the Eastern Bloc countries, which were in effect controlled by Russia. And the Russian Premier Putin, who was a former KGB guy, who was running the Soviet government, or the Russian government, not unlike the way it was run under the Soviets, or at least he's starting to, wants the guy who the election said won to be in place. The Bush administration, ironically enough, has demanded the fair and accurate elections. And if there's any sense of irony in that, you'll have to... oh, boy. Anyway. But, you know, there's a lot of nasty stuff going on. And the Ukrainians are very proud people. There's also a lot of resources in the Ukraine. It's the breadbasket of Russia. It's where most of their wheat grows. And that's, one of the biggest wheat-producing areas of the world. So it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out here. The Russians have had a falling out with Chechnya, which was another one of their republics, which wanted independence. And there was and has been some nasty fighting back and forth with that. So will that happen in Ukraine? I don't know. But what I do know is that unlike here in America, the Russians took to the streets to protest what they thought was a crooked election result. I'm convinced that it was a crooked election result here in this country, both now and in 2000, but no one's out in the streets. Everyone's, oh, well, nothing to see here. Move along. We'll pay the price for that. We'll pay the price for that. Anyway, there's, you know, this is what goes on in this country, where the New York Times had had an editorial talking about how, you know, the Bush administration, you wonder if they're going to, you know, try to be moderate for a change. And it's like, why would you think they would even consider that? You know, and I don't understand, you know, when I read these New York Times editorials and they try to sound reasonable and they try to sound forthright and all that, you know, up and standing and all that stuff. And it's like, what the hell are they thinking? You know, so we hope Mr. Bush will pursue a more moderate term in his second term than he did in his first. And it's like, no, what makes you think that? What makes you think in any way, shape or form they're going to do that? They have what they now call a mandate of 51-49 mandate. Now, for those of you who don't know the term mandate, and again, I'm sure pretty much all of you do, but a mandate is an overwhelming amount of support. Franklin Delano Roosevelt had a mandate because not only was he elected, but damn near every Republican in 1932 was kicked out of office. It was a huge groundswell of support. Mr. Roosevelt won four elections by huge margins where it's absolutely no controversy. It was a clear mandate for him to change the country. You could even make the argument that it was a clear mandate for Ronald Reagan when he was elected. Because he got, especially in 1984, he got a fairly significant portion of the vote. Not as much as Roosevelt did, mind you. But he got a fair amount of portion for the vote. Mind you, they did their cheating in their own way back then. But that's a completely different story. Because I'm still certain that the Reagans and the Bushes interfered with the negotiations with the Iranians to keep the hostages in Iran until after the election. And then, of course, there was the whole Iran-Contra business later on, where we sold weapons to those self-same Iranians in order to make these guys look good politically. Never mind that it was against the law. And when push came to shove, Mr. Bush pardoned a whole shitload of people who would have shown evidence of Mr. Bush's own involvement, despite him saying he was quote-unquote out of the loop, which, of course, was horseshit. And now it's the same group of people in charge. In case people have forgotten, the ambassador to Iraq is John Negroponte, known as the Central American Killer. He was the one who set up a lot of the torture things going on in Central America during the Contra Wars, and now he's in charge of Iraq as far as America is concerned. Isn't that lovely, ladies and gentlemen? Isn't that wonderful? Yeah, he's the ambassador. He's not the governor like Bremer was and the guy after him was. No. He is the ambassador. But the reality is he's probably de facto running the country behind the scenes, probably working with Mr. Alawi, who was our little puppet out there. We love to do that stuff. We always talk about freedom and all that stuff, but when it really comes down to it, we really don't care about that. What we care about is having someone that we can control so that it works in our best interests, never mind the interests of the ideals that we're supposed to stand for. And when we talk about our best interests, we're not talking about the best interests of American workers who have in general, will wind up getting screwed by these policies. What is the New York Times edit? Listen to this. Said, what do his critics fear that Mr. Bush will do? Some speculate that he will want to challenge Iran over its nuclear initiatives, spurning the freeze recently negotiated by Britain, France, and Germany. Or they feel that he will unilaterally increase the pressure on North Korea after years of multilateral frustration. Some are more concerned that he will widen the campaign for democracy in the Middle East beyond Iraq, the obvious target for removal by military means being the Ba'athist dictatorship of Syria, which has exposed itself to retaliation by aiding terrorism in Iraq. And most assume that the president will want much wider action to suppress the insurgency in Iraq, with the reconquest of Fallujah only a first step. But while re-elected presidents, who no longer have to face the voters, are theoretically free to pursue their wildest dreams, in practice they never do. This is a presidency, Mr. and Mrs. Editorial Board, whoever the hell you are. I'm not going to bother to look it up right now. But you're full of it. This is a presidency unlike any presidency we've seen probably in 100 or so years. Not since the days of prior to Teddy Roosevelt. Who was it? McKinley? Who was it, the guy that Karl Rove says he wants to emulate? The guy who put that one president into office. I think it was McKinley. But not since those days have we seen a government as corrupt and as against the actual citizens of America in power. The only difference between then and now is that then we didn't have nuclear capabilities to screw around with the rest of the world. Pardon me a minute. A little bit of water there. Got to get the throat going. I need more interviews. It's hard talking about this stuff. This is hard work. This is hard work. But I don't understand why they would think that he would he would do anything of the kind. He can do whatever he wants, and, you know, quite frankly, they're going to allow him to do anything he wants. You know, when Clinton was in office, the slightest little transgressions were elevated to page one news. Now we have actual impeachable offenses that are kind of buried along the side or just kind of dismissed as tinfoil hat theories, conspiracy theories. You know, what's it going to take? You know, what's it going to take for things to finally change, for people to finally wake up and realize not only did the emperor not have any clothes, he got no brains either. Yeah, they're good at grabbing power. No one doubts that. But again, as I've said over and over again, what good is that when you don't know what to do with the power when you get it? You have to have a plan for it once you have it. Their only plan is, well, we've got this. Now how do we get more of it? And that's really all they care about. And there's no end to it. And the only way they manage to get people to go along with it is to scare them, to manipulate them, to take advantage of their trust and their loyalty, as I said in the last segment. To lie to them, because quite frankly, they don't care. The ends justify the means to these people. That's the way they think. That's the way they are. If they want to get the support of Christians, they'll sit there and swear in a Bible and, you know, make the sign of the cross all the time or do what, you know, say what they think their supporters will say. And some of the hardcore Christians, the ones who write me emails saying that any true Christian who is really God-fearing knows who to vote for in this election, they've bought into it hook, line, and sinker, man. They've bought into it hook, line, or sinker. Somehow I have a lot of difficulty imagining that Jesus is looking down on us slaughtering Iraqis and cheering them on because it's a war between Jesus and Muhammad. I get the idea that Jesus is not happy about that. I can't prove it because I don't know what's in Jesus' mind or Jesus' heart. But hey, I can't imagine that. And quite frankly, if Jesus did support this, then I don't support Jesus. There are some things that are just plain fucking wrong. There are some things that are just wrong. Going to war based on a lie for the profit of a few and for the diminishment of everybody overall is just wrong. But, you know, the Republican supporters don't see it that way. Oh, we're in charge now. We can do what we want. That's all they care about. That's all they're interested in. And that's that. And there's nothing you can do to change their minds. You know, in the election, the only chance we really had is to get the 50 or so, well, I think there was a little bit more, but about the 45 or 50% of the people who don't vote at all, get a few of them involved. Get enough of them involved, and you can overturn this. When you look at the raw numbers of the population overall, you're talking about maybe 20 to 21% of the people of this country actually put Mr. Bush in office. That's one-fifth. That's hardly a mandate. There was really about maybe 30 or 40% of the people overall that put Mr. Clinton in office. While it wasn't a mandate, Mr. Clinton wasn't trying to ramrod a war down everybody's throat. And you say, well, Bosnia, Bosnia. Well, you know something? People named streets after Clinton in Bosnia. They cheer him enthusiastically in Bosnia and in Ireland, where he helped the peace process out. He can go anywhere in Europe and be treated like Elvis, for crying out loud, like he's a rock star. Not what my wife pointed out. Not one soldier that Mr. Clinton sent into combat died. Think about that. Not one soldier. There were a few suicides. There was a couple of suicides in there. Somebody committed suicide in Haiti. And the people who died in Somalia, well, Clinton didn't send them into Somalia. Mr. Bush sent those people into Somalia, the first Mr. Bush. That was a nice little present. Pardon me again. But as Bart Kopp pointed out, since Clinton was in office for a few months when the Somalia thing happened and we lost 18 soldiers, they all blamed him like it was his personal fault. When it was Bush that put him in and Bush who didn't give the soldiers there enough armor or support to do the job that they needed to do. Now we've had over 1,200 soldiers dead in Iraq. Because they have, and most of them would not have died if they had had the proper armor, if they had had the proper support, if they had gone in there with enough troops to do the job for real to begin with. But the press doesn't want to talk about that. Oh, move along. Nothing to see here. Oh, look at that explosion. Isn't that cute? Oh, look, Janet Jackson's breast. Oh, look, the girl from Desperate Housewives gets naked with Terrell Owens. That's more important. My wife is sneezing. Hang on. Hold it up. You can get, let it out. Let it out. Go ahead. You can sneeze. I love these little moments of poignancy. It just goes to show where the country's gone in the last 25 or 30 years. When you have a corporate-controlled media, when you have a corporate-controlled government, that's what things are coming to. It's gotten worse for the working people, that's for sure. We have less protections than we had before. Now I read a story about that, how Walmart is going to allow workers to unionize in China, where the unions in China, you might as well be in management. They might as well, because everything they do is really fits into Walmart's policy. And you know what I'm talking about. Anybody who's out there working for them knows exactly what I'm talking about. If the boss asks you to work extra hours, you do it because you're afraid. If you don't do it, you'll lose your job. Never mind if you've got something else to do. You're supposed to put to work first and foremost. And you don't have to. They can't put a gun to your head and make you do it, but they can threaten your livelihood because they expect you to have not just the same amount of desire for the company, but even more in some cases, because a lot of times they don't even sacrifice that much time themselves. When I was working at that print shop, I don't know how many times I had to go in on a weekend to fix a deal that a salesman had made. You know, and I told one of the salespeople, I said, yeah, you know, you get a nice big bonus and we get dick. And that's basically the truth. And she said, well, I don't appreciate that attitude. Well, what attitude do you expect me to have? I have to give up my time and all I get is a few dollars of overtime pay. And they get a big bonus just because they made a promise to a customer that they didn't have to worry about keeping because we would be there to back them up. And the situation's only getting worse. I was watching, they had a whole bunch of Roseanne episodes on, and I like that show because it is really, especially the earlier episodes, it really has an example of a lot of the things that go on. And there was the great episode with Fred Thompson, who was, I think he still is a senator from Tennessee, a Republican senator. But he played a boss there, and they worked at a plastics factory, a manufacturing type of plant, not unlike what I'm working at now, although they dealt in plastics and not steel. And he had set the quotas for their production very, very high, much higher than they were used to. And everybody was freaking out because they had to work so much extra overtime or they had to work so hard while they were there. And it was ruining everybody's lives because they didn't have the time to do the thing. So Roseanne went up to the guy, and he knew that Roseanne was the biggest troublemaker because, you know, I'm kind of like that too. She's got a big mouth. She doesn't put up with a lot of BS. And she had been working at that plant, and according to the show, for about 10 to 12 years. So she made a deal with him that he would lower the quotas if she stopped mouthing off so much and helped out a little bit. And, of course, you know, he did that. But then he started, you know, pushing Roseanne around a little bit and seeing how, you know, what she would do. And once he felt she was broken, he brought the quotas back up to what they were before. And Roseanne was furious. And she went into his office and said, what the hell are you doing? You know, well, you know, once I broke you, I can break anybody else now. You know, so she just quit. And not only did she quit, she took five or six of her coworkers with her. It hurt her in the short term, but in the long term, it all wound up better for everybody. Her friends found other and better jobs. And Mr. Thompson went on to become senator for a party that is going to help managers like that. Because when you're worried about your work and when you're worried about your ability to find work, and trust me, finding work in this day and age is very, very hard, and I'm not looking forward to the prospect again if and when I get laid off at the end of January. Maybe somebody out there can pick me up. Hello, radio show host here. And I can get put on. You know, I can actually do a much better show if I have a producer and I have somebody to help me do a little bit of research so I have something to talk about so I don't have to yammer on around here. I've been talking for almost 21 minutes here and I still don't understand a word I've said. No, that's not entirely true. But things are just going to get worse for us working people, and we're just going to have to learn to deal with it. And meanwhile, Bush is sitting there with his mandates. And the question is, what is he going to do? Are they taking their time to do stuff? The Republicans are going to try to make a filibuster rule so that the Democrats can't even filibuster. They have a bare majority in the Senate and the House. I mean, 55 to 45 is a lot, but it's not an overwhelming amount. You need 60 to get a supermajority. If they had 60, then they wouldn't even have to worry. But now they're trying to fix the rules so that you only need a majority to end the filibuster. And if that happens, then they can really do whatever they want. And it's the same in the House. They only have a few seats lead in the House. And like I said before the election, it was going to have taken an overwhelming amount of support for Mr. Kerry. So we're talking somewhere along the lines of 70 to 80% of the vote in order for him to overcome all the bullshit and cheating that's going to go on. And of course, he wasn't going to get that. And even so, what good would it have done if he would have won? The Republicans still would have controlled Congress. We're going to need a movement not unlike the New Deal movement. And it's going to take time to build, so we'd better learn to be patient. And it may seem bad now, and it is bad now, but eventually things will get better. I believe that. I've said that before, and I'll say it again. Things will get better. You know, Gandhi said that thugs eventually get what they deserve, and I believe that that's going to be the true in this case. It may take a while, but, you know, eventually that sort of thing is going to happen. I mean, you know, you can't go on like that. If we don't stop them here in this country, they'll get stopped by outside forces because the rest of the world is not going to put up with it. And, you know, I sincerely doubt that anybody's going to want to be sending nukes out over this. And we don't have the kind of military we need to go after our allies, as well as trying to take out the so-called axis of evil. I really don't know what their plans are. I really don't know what the future holds. I do know things are going to get worse for working people here in America in the short term. And I do know pretty surely that things are going to get better in the long term. But, you know, it's just, you know, we have to be patient. Like I said, we have to take time for it. Time is, after all, on our side. In the long term, time is on our side. Anyway, I see by the clock on the wall that it's time for me to go. I've got a new closing here today, so I hope you enjoy that. It was sent to me by a cool guy who emailed it to me, and you can listen to that. And I'm going to say my goodbyes. This is Joe Vecchio from the Cup of Joe Radio Show signing out, saying goodbye. Bye.
The host of the Cup of Joe Radio Show is proud to be a member of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 2127. However, the views of Joe Vecchio do not necessarily represent the views of Local 2127, the IBEW, or its affiliate, the AFL-CIO. Please remember to support your working brothers and sisters and help keep the American dream alive. The Cup of Joe Radio Show has been a production of Jove Enterprises, Incorporated.
A plate of Dave, creamer of Steve, a mug of Doug.
Harbor.